Speak. The charm of make, charm of make, charm of make, charm.
There will come a time on the planet Earth when science and technology will be long forgotten. When wizards will rule the world.
This is the Arnomancy Podcast. Join your host, Reverend Eric, and his diverse array of amazing guests in an exploration of tarot, magic, the occult, and the history of Western esotericism. The Arnomancy Podcast exists thanks to the support of generous listeners like you. Please consider supporting this podcast for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/arnomancy. Welcome back to the Arnomancy Podcast, the Arnomancy Show. I don't know, the Arnomancy something or other. I am your host, Reverend Eric, and with me today is Dr. Matt Dragonstone, astrologer, tarot reader, astromage, all-around nice guy, and human with a cool last name. Dr. Matt, Dr. Dragonstone. Man, that sounds like a superhero name. Welcome to Arnomancy.
Thank you so much, Reverend Eric. Good morning slash afternoon slash evening to you and all listeners. Hello, how are you going?
I really enjoyed being on your show, and I was really impressed with your, equanimity, your level-headedness at handling my really, really horrible internet connection. I'm going to put a little bit of a feeler out there right now. I'm using Xfinity for internet. My internet quality degraded horribly right around the beginning of the year, and it has not improved, and I have no idea how to get in touch with support people at Xfinity to get that fixed or to have them check it or anything. Like, they're so difficult to work with, and they're raising their prices, and I'm just sort of like, this is the most annoying place to be. So if anybody out there has any ideas, let me know. Otherwise, let's talk about weird shit, which is what we are all here for, right?
Absolutely, my friend. Yes, I'm totally down for weird shit, mate.
So we're going to be continuing some topics from our conversation that we started on Matt's podcast, on the Dragonstone podcast. There will be a link to that in the show notes, and I also republished it in my feed a couple episodes ago. So go back and listen to that before you listen to this one, and also subscribe to Matt's podcast while you're doing it, just because it's cool and he gets a lot of cool guests and has smart things to say about stuff. And so we're going to be discussing sort of Agrippa and kind of like Agrippa in postmodernity and some logical fallacies that are important to pay attention to when engaging with kind of this older material. So that's sort of, I think, where we're going to start. Do you want to start us off, Matt?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thanks for that lovely shout out for my podcast. You did a great job doing my outro for me last time, just FYI. I think that a good place to start is the appeal to antiquity or the appeal to tradition, which mm-hmm. we touched on last time, under extreme duress. But, one of the things that caught me was the way that Agrippa likes to, you know, appeal to antiquity or appeal to tradition when mm-hmm. justifying a particular position. And, you know, this is a wonderful logical fallacy because in a nutshell, it's my statement is true because it doesn't come from me. It comes from someone or something much older than me. And by virtue of the degree to which it's older than me, that is the degree to which it's true. There's this baked in sort of assumption that very old things are very true because we still have them. And mm-hmm. Agrippa's down with that because he's not necessarily trying to revolutionize the tropes that he's working with, writing in the 1500s, in Germany. And one thing that I've noticed is we like to assume a particular position in postmodernity in 2024 when we're reading authors like Agrippa, that we're not also falling into the same logical fallacy. We're not also guilty of assuming that Agrippa is very true because he's very old. That's kind of in a nutshell what I was trying to get at last time.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting because I think a big part of the appeal to antiquity in Agrippa's time came from kind of like this Christian notion. The Catholic philosophy was basically that closer to the beginning of creation, everything was closer to divine and thus better, and everything's just been falling apart and falling apart, and it'll keep falling apart until the second coming. right? So that appeal to antiquity is sort of saying, like, well, things were better back then, so of course they were more correct.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I'm going to do an appeal to antiquity now. I just thought of a nice witty comeback, and then I thought, that's an appeal to antiquity. There's an older tradition than the church that uses the same appeal to antiquity, and which is relevant to the context in which Agrippa would have been writing, and a lot of esoteric authors, you know, basically since the beginning, there's another appeal to antiquity. So, you know, Plato is a great example of, first of all, the kind of esoteric underpinnings of the church when it came around. And, you know, that's a whole thing that we can get into. But Plato does an amazing array of you know, appeals to tradition and appeals to antiquity in the dialogues, one of which we can find, for instance, in the Timaeus, where he talks about the origins of Atlantis and the acrobatics that author goes through to kind of establish a ridiculous antiquity that goes beyond the Greeks to the Egyptians, and then from the Egyptians you get the story of Atlantis. That's one example amongst many. And there are, of course, pre-Socratic, pre-Platonic authors that do the same thing. It seems to be something that just is a current that was running through a lot of thought, not just esoteric, but also philosophical and just general writings up to and including the present age, but definitely at the time that Agrippa was writing. And that additional overlay where, you know, the beginning of creation, everything was close to God, things are falling to shit, and then the Messiah comes again, and we get the kind of great reset, so to speak. That's just, I guess, the form that it was taking during Agrippa's time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But except that I think that there was also a new current moving into European Christianity, because Agrippa was right around the time of Martin Luther. So Martin Luther and in particular, sort of like, you know, the John Calvin and the Calvinists and stuff brought in this appeal to novelty, which was sort of talking about, like, well, actually, they didn't frame it as an appeal to novelty. They also framed it as an appeal to tradition. Like, Christianity before the Catholic Church was better, you know, back before, we have to reach back to our roots, which is interesting. I really thought that I was going to bring in some appeal to novelty there, but I think that they also, it was sort of a battle between antiquities that they were having.
It is. And do you know what? Like, the appeal to novelty is something that is very old. Sorry.
Well, I mean, if it's that old, it must be right.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, it's something that I think characterizes the modernity, that you can draw a lineage down to Luther, I think, as the beginnings of modernity, right, in terms of changing the worldview that people were operating under. And, you know, what you've got there is the beginning of the appeal to novelty as a new tradition, which is paradoxical, but why not? And it's something that I think we get running through, and it reaches, I think, its crescendo around the time of the Enlightenment and the time of the, you know, the industrial and scientific revolutions, obviously.
I am not convinced that it's left that crescendo. I think we're still in the middle of it. I mean, look at how the appeal to novelty drives technology adoption right now, for instance.
Mm, yeah, no, fair point. But what we've got, I think, now is this, you know, I mean, you touched on the term post-modernity and post-modernism. We're using a really sophisticated platform, by the way. Riverside FM looks like a lovely place to visit. And I'll be switching over. I'll be looking for a tenancy myself in this building. But we're using this really sophisticated technological platform to do something that's become increasingly popular amongst esoteric circles. I mean, the wider esoteric circles, which is to talk about very old things and very old people. Using extremely new technology. And if I can perform my own self-referential appeal to antiquity, because I'm very old, when I was getting into this, it was incredibly new age. That was de rigueur, right? In spiritual circles, spiritual praxis. You know, I'm a 90s Wiccan kid, and, you know, I was a very sort of dark and stormy goth kid when I was growing up, and my introduction was incredibly new age. And I thought the appeal
I never would have guessed that from your last name at all.
Yeah, exactly, right. But the appeal to antiquity with Wicca was the 70s and, you know, back sort of during World War II. And I thought that was, you know, pretty cool. And the vibe was more so, you know, this is new thought, this is new ways, neo-paganism is the way to go. And that seemed to kind of characterize a lot of the 90s, early 2000s kind of, you know, trends. But in the past decade or two, we've had the resurgence of very old people and very old things, and are re-looking at very old people and very old things. And with, you know, astrology is a prime example. We have, thanks to Chris Brennan, the rise of very, very old astrology as the new norm. And we're back in this kind of looking back at old things and treating them as more new, while we're also hurtling, you know, simultaneously towards, you know, this kind of technological singularity, which means that for future episodes of our podcast will be done by deepfakes and we can just sit on the beach and drink Mai Tais, right?
We don't even have to think anymore.
Exactly.
This is great.
Yeah. So we've got an appeal to antiquity paradoxically nestled within a hyper-modernity, which I think might be novel, but I'm not discounting the possibility that Agrippa thought he was doing the same thing. And even, you know, to go back to Plato and pre-Platonic, pre-Socratic thought. Sorry.
Yeah, let me think about that for a second. Did Agrippa think he was doing the same thing? I think it's really difficult to say that about people who were kind of like in the grips of the European Renaissance. You know, Agrippa got a lot of his Platonic ideas and his Neoplatonism and the Hermetic stuff from the Italian Renaissance. And the Italian Renaissance was definitely kind of an appeal to tradition in a way, right? Plato and the Neoplatonists, when their material was reintroduced to Europe, they were kind of seen as like, you know, incredibly extra wise because they were so old. And I think in a lot of ways, so, okay, but here's the thing, like Agrippa, you know, a big part of Three Books of Occult Philosophy is like a cataloging or an encyclopedia-ing or an anthology of like earlier works, but he definitely was kind of like gluing it together with his own stuff. So did he think he was doing something novel, or did he think he was rediscovering an ancient art?
I don't know. A good question. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good question. But, you know, I draw your attention to a lot of the discourse that happens currently in esoteric circles. And I'll ask you I'll answer the question with a question to be a true philosopher.
I mean, that's the old way to do it. So I think it's the right way.
The old way. The old way is the best way. But are we not currently in the grips of a Renaissance ourselves, right? We could characterize, and it has been characterized as a Renaissance of tradition, you know, etc.
In occult circles, like in the, how we've got, or in what sense can you?
Well, we've a lot of the discourse that comes from, I guess, the context that I spend a lot of my time in, which is astrology, is we have a Hellenistic Renaissance. We have a traditionalist astrological Renaissance. We have a Renaissance of esoteric and occult praxis that's happening right now. And the way that we're doing it right now is to combine new technology with very old ideas, and that seems to be okay. It's working for us. Otherwise, you know, taking us out of context, we would have never have met or had this conversation because we're separated by a lot of distance. But, you know, can we not take what we're currently experiencing, which I would probably argue quite strongly that this is characteristic of what a Renaissance is, and assume that ipso facto, because we're in a Renaissance and this is how we're doing it, Agrippa might have had similar approaches in the Renaissance that he was within, like that he was operating within.
Okay, I like that thought. Let's talk through that a little bit. So I'm not as involved in the world of astrology as you are, but I have certainly, one of the things that I have seen throughout my time in the occultosphere is sort of a reacceptance and embrace of astrology, primarily because I think the Renaissance in astrology that you've been talking about has been kind of discarding some of the novelty, right? Like newer astrologers who are looking at like older Hellenistic stuff are discarding the psychological model of astrology and looking at earlier models and trying to be like, no, hold on a second, maybe there's something else here that we didn't understand. And in doing so, opened up sort of like the gateway or the doorway between astrology and the occult world, Western esotericism, in a way that maybe had been ignored for a few centuries.
Mm. Yeah, that's
the makes case. Sense.
It does make sense, and much to astrology's detriment, that it's thrown out a lot of.
Oh, much to magic's detriment too.
Yeah. I mean,
we both slipped into this. I think both sides of the equation slipped into this appeal to novelty that was like, oh, here's psychology. Here's a way for us to approach these through a modern or even postmodern lens and achieve, you know, validity in scientific circles, which are basically, you know, married to novelty. And I think that really hurt all of us a lot.
Oh, but by all means. And I think the thing that's truly novel about the conditions under which we're sort of operating and doing work and writing books and doing the actual work is atheistic materialism, right? So we could say postmodernity, mm-hmm. but that's kind of incorporating an atheistic materialist sort of stance that is absolutely okay. not present in Agrippa and absolutely not present prior to the scientific revolution, really.
Yeah, I'd say, late 1600s at the very earliest.
Yeah, exactly. And not to make this an astrology episode, but to take it out of the context that I work in, I observe this elsewhere. I'm not 100% germane with the occultosphere, although I'm an occult practitioner. I make, astrological talismans. I do astromagic. But let's look at sort of Catholicism and esoteric Christianity, and from my perspective on the exoteric side, right, like looking inwards, the rise of traditional Catholicism seems to be something that's popped up kind of simultaneously with the Renaissance in traditional thought in astrology, and there's a lot of pre-Vatican II, let's bring it back to the Latin Mass, let's get right back because it was better when it was older, that's coming through in, exoteric Catholic circles. Maybe you're better placed to provide a commentary on what you've observed in esoteric Christianity, like given that you might be closer to it than me. I'm definitely on the outside of that.
I am frankly not close to esoteric Christianity at all. Okay, maybe that's probably too strong. I have friends who practice it and such, but I myself am not an esoteric Christian or any kind of Christian.
No. I'm not implying that you are. But the kind of work that you do, you might be closer to that kind
of spiritual. I honestly haven't spent enough time paying attention to it. So that would be a really difficult thing for me to speculate on. Like, I think I don't know. I would have to speculate too wildly. I that's beyond my ken.
Okay.
I'm going to put that on my list.
Yeah.
Find weird Christians for podcast.
Yeah, find the weird Christians. All right, so maybe a different track would be let's look at, initiatic hermetic orders.
Okay.
And what is current within the discourse, yeah? And was there ever an appeal to novelty there?
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's interesting. That's a really interesting way to look at things, because I think that if we go back to the 1800s when stuff like, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was starting, I think that they were kind of like you know, they were developing their magical system and their magical order right around the same time that William James was developing psychology, right? Like they were kind of contemporaries. And so in the 20th century, in the early 20th century, when you had new age, you know, the new thought, new age movement, or the new thought movement, I guess, sort of like coming out of and then reintroducing itself to the occult movements and sort of influencing them, you ended up with stuff like, you know, the builders of the Dedum, I can't remember the names of all of them. There's so many different, you know, there's like the Brotherhood of Light, the Hermetic Brothers of Light, the, you know, Temple of Luxor. I don't remember all their names, but right around that time. So, you know, like Paul Foster Case, Manly P. Hall, Dion Fortune, A.E. Waite, like all of those people who were like early 20th century, super, super influential in the development of modern ceremonial magic in particular, like they kind of tended to embrace psychological models. Israel Regardi, I guess, would be another one who kind of did that. Maybe Aleister Crowley, though I am not going to claim to understand his philosophy very much. I don't really read his material very often. But the Renaissance part of it, the Renaissance that we're talking about, like really started at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. So maybe like, you know, maybe less than 30 years ago, where people started looking at older materials more seriously. You know, like Llewellyn's version of the Three Books of Occult Philosophy came out in maybe like 92, 94. I don't think that people paid attention to it very much as an actual book of occult philosophy because it was still really hard to read. I mean, I don't remember really encountering this, like the spirit model of magic or models of magic that really kind of acknowledged divinity and a spirit world and the importance of sort of like a Neoplatonic realm or something until like 2010. I do think you're right that we're in the middle of a renaissance. And I think that part of that is, okay, here's where my exploration of it has led me to. It seems that when the rush to embrace novelty when the appeal to novelty becomes too strong, good ideas get left behind. You know, I don't want to, because I mean, part of the fallacy is sort of that you end up thinking that, you know, the novelty is always good or good too much of the time, and thus, you know, the traditional or the antiquated is too antiquated and should be thrown away. And so I think that one of the problems is we end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater pretty often. I hate saying that. I feel like I've been using that metaphor a lot, and I need to come up with a better one.
Oh, I love babies out... in bathwater. Just throw them all away. Like babies in bathwater is a great, great metaphor. Sorry.
You throw out the wheat with the weevils.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome.
So I think that that's kind of... that's kind of the danger of the appeal to novelty. But at the same time, I think that as the Renaissance is occurring, we still have to be really careful about what we pull out of, you know, we have to be careful that we don't fall prey to the appeal to tradition. And that we don't let it tell us, like, this old stuff has to all be right. I think I'm kind of agreeing with some of the stuff you were saying about, you know, modern technology sort of mixing with astrology. Like, you don't have to be a mathematician to be an astrologer anymore.
Oh, God, no. I couldn't hand draw a chart if someone had a gun to my head, like, if my life depended.
Oh, I bet you could then.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't be an accurate chart, but I'd just be like, here's some
numbers. You'd be like, oh, no, look, there's a circle.
Yeah, that's Please don't get my family.
Put some planets in it.
But, you know, in terms of drawing an accurate chart, there's no way I could be a court astrologer anymore, for instance. Like, I couldn't do astrology if my life, as though my life depended on it in that sense. But what you're describing with the appeal to novelty when it reaches a particular kind of threshold that, you know, there's also... It seems like there's also a simultaneous appeal to antiquity that runs alongside it. And with your example of the, you know, the Brotherhood of Light, the you know, the Golden Dawn, etc., existing concurrently with William James developing the beginnings of psychology, the timeline that I noticed with your example was in the 90s, when you've got Llewellyn's, you know, translation of three books of occult philosophy developing. You've also got the crescendo of 90s chaos magic. Particularly. And that is crazy stuff. Like, I'm a big fan of chaos magic. I do sigils all the time. I'm doing the sigil.
I am too, but like, chaos magic definitely has its roots in atheistic materialism. Like, it is sort of the apex of magic and atheist materialism, like, trying to work together. In the process, sort of like doing a lot of explaining and reinventing of a lot of concepts, you know, sort of reinventing things and then giving them new names because, you know, I mean, they didn't have they weren't reading the older material.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just kind of wondering tentatively if we can't see a parallel in Agrippa's time between what was a tremendously novel and radical idea, which is, you know, Protestantism and Lutheranism, occurring concurrently with this, you know, piece. And I don't want to turn three books of occult philosophy into just a book of history, because it's an excellent working, you know, document.
Yeah.
And I've used it in the past without much philosophical reflection, like we discussed last time, as a book of very excellent correspondences and recipes for talismans and things like that. But, you know, what you've got is, in as much as it's drawing on antiquity to kind of establish a strand of esoteric thought, you can see simultaneously with Lutheranism something that was quite simply world-destroying. Yeah.
The
Catholic model, I mean, just going out the window, and it's like, oh, you don't need a priest? What are you talking about? You can have a personal relationship with God. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, and also just like, you know, the cojones it took to stand up to power like that.
Great cojones. I haven't had cojones in ages. Yes, no, Luther must have had big swinging cojones, my friend.
Do you not? I suppose you probably don't have a whole lot of Spanish speakers down there.
Not a lot, no. I think I know most of the Spanish.
You know, it's sort of a second language up in this area.
Yeah, yeah. No, that must have been like big cojones to do that. But again, like, don't we have similar big swinging cojones at the moment with, you know, the way in which our worldview is being destroyed? Because AI is, whoever came up with that, but those are some big cojones.
Those are some big cojones. I would say that there are similarly large cojones, but maybe not, they may not be operating from as delicate a position as Luther had. Like, I'm gonna say something that nobody should take as actual fact, because I am speculating only, but it seems to me that a lot of appeal to novelty these days that is being driven, you know, by the things like AI or tech adoption, that stuff seems to be backed by billionaires who are, and I mean, the skeptical part of me just wants to say that they are doing everything they can to manipulate a system to serve themselves. So I'm not sure that it takes cojones when you've already shown that you are a vile enough human to sacrifice the well-being of, you know, billions and billions of people to support yourself. Like, that's not cojones. That's poison.
Oh, totally. But, you know, I mean, Pico della Mirandola and, you know, other writers in Florence under the Medicis would have been operating in similar circumstances, though, with tyrannical ass faces who just happen to have a lot of money.
Yeah. Who were able to patronize. Oh, for sure. For sure.
And yeah, you know, I'm not comparing modern day wizards, coders, things like this with, you know, esotericists who are operating under patronage. But, you know, money talks, and I think it's talked since the beginning of time. And
whew.
You know,
I feel like I'm going to turn Gnostic Christian by the end of this episode. I'm like, no, get me out of here.
But, you know, in a sense, if you zoom out far enough, what I'm kind of advocating is a cyclical view of history and a cyclical view of time, and using that as a means to kind of draw comparisons between where we are at the moment and where Agrippa was and where multiple points in history have kind of instantiated. Too much in one direction will trigger a reverb in the opposite direction.
Oh, Hegel alert.
Well, more so Derrida alert, actually. it's the philosophical Derrida that I'm talking about, because post-modernity, you can kind of draw that back to Derrida in a lot of senses. And I'm not just saying that because my PhD thesis was on Derrida and Plato. What you get, I think, with some of Derrida's writings that kind of kick off postmodern discourse is textual instances where binary opposition gets kind of dissolved a little bit, and you start to get into these crazy scenarios where the binaries operate simultaneously and one becomes subtextual and one becomes more overt, and it's not a long bow to draw to kind of substitute those two terms with exoteric, esoteric, or occult and mundane or vulgar, whatever the antonym of occult is.
I think vulgar. I mean, here's of course the censure for that for people listening.
You see, this is the part where I have to think of a witty line, because Eric played the keytar last time, and I have no keytar. I might have a kalimba. I'm not sure. In fact, I'm going to go and find the damn thing. Yeah. Okay, so I assumed this would happen, but I didn't have a musical instrument a la Eric's interlude last time. But this is a little number I like to call Waiting for the Rev. I think this is probably going to happen every time that I talk about Derrida. There's got to be some sort of trigger. I don't think it's 100% Xfinity's fault. Quite often with esoteric podcasts and occult podcasts, the gremlin game is pretty strong. So there's got to be some sort of trigger, folks. And I'm imagining that we'll find out which one that is as the podcast goes on. So, you know, this could be a drinking game if you're listening at home. Just take a shot every time we talk about Derrida or deconstruction, or, you know, have a shot every time we talk about, maybe Agrippa's the trigger, right? Maybe if we were doing this episode about something other than Agrippa, we'd have more luck. Oh, here's the Reverend again. Okay, what have we got?
Good, good. Okay, I'm back. All right, so let's see. You had asked, so I do have something to ask you, but you had asked something about, like, what's the opposite of the occult? Vulgar? And I was like, yes, but that's, of course, we have to look at, like, the original meaning of occult as hidden and vulgar as common. So, like,
yes.
We're not saying vulgar things are, like, vulgar as in, you know, disgusting, although some of them could be.
They could be, yeah.
Yeah, but heck, I mean, lots of occult things are pretty disgusting, too.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, some of those incense recipes in Agrippa are pretty rank.
Okay, here's a question that I have for you. So I am not super good at 20th century philosophy. Can you give us a little bit of a rundown on Derrida?
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I'm referring to a French philosopher who was active in the middle of the 20th century until the very, very early part of the 21st century. His name's Jacques Derrida, and I know I've mispronounced that, but he was French, so we need to assume that I'll be mispronouncing literally everything, because the Australian accent is not renowned for its subtlety and nuance, particularly when it comes to other languages. So, Derrida, a Parisian, Algerian philosopher, Sephardic Jewish, Algerian French philosopher, operating in Paris, middle of the 20th century, most renowned for his work on deconstruction, right? A lot of people, and because I made the mistake of doing a PhD on Derrida, I'm going to start like everyone who's done a PhD on everything by saying that everyone's opinion of the subject of my PhD is false.
Wait, so are you literally a PhD? You are literally a doctor of philosophy.
Yes, yeah, that's where the doctor part comes from, yeah.
Well, I know. I mean, but you know, people get PhDs in all sorts of fields now, but you're literally like the OG type.
Yeah, that was my attempt at a normal career, was doing a PhD in philosophy, because I thought academia might be one way that I could like have a day job that's kind of kind of esoteric. Yeah, no, it didn't work. It corresponded with my Saturn return too. It was a fucking shit show. But a lot of people who do PhDs in anything will tell you that the subject that they've researched, everyone's current interpretation is wrong. And I'm going to say the same thing about deconstruction, because everyone says that the term deconstruction, to deconstruct something, when we deconstruct a salad or an idea or a gender, you know, we're doing a thing, and Derrida's, you know, discovered that. Or came up with the term. I disagree, but it is what he's most famous for. My reading of Derrida is that he observed something that happens in literary texts initially with the early part of his work that he termed deconstruction. It's slightly different, but you know, it's a significant point that he more or less observed it happening and then came up with the term rather than invented a methodology. So deconstruction, you know, in a nutshell, is a thing that happens in texts, okay? So Derrida's big thing at the beginning of his career, in his later work, he moved more into using a deconstructive approach or observing deconstruction in ethical ideas, and he did a lot of good ethical work before he passed away. But first and foremost, he was someone who read other philosophers and other authors and observed and pointed out the moments at which deconstruction occurred in the ideas that we would assume normally apply to those philosophers. Very famously, he did it with Plato, and that was the tiny little 1 millimeter wide niche in which I devoted 4 additional years of my life in postgraduate study. So when I talk about Derrida, when I talk about postmodernity, and when a lot of people talk about these topics, what they're referring to is this kind of baseline phenomena, which is deconstruction. And deconstruction would be observing binary oppositions within texts, yeah? And we can see the crossover from postmodernity into current gender theory almost initially, right, when we talk about
binary opposition. Okay.
But in a textual analysis kind of context, we look at what is the most blatant example of one end of the binary opposition, and then where in the text is the occult? I'm going to use that term. Derrida didn't really use that term, but in this context it applies. Where is the occult term, and how can we bring that into the same kind of stance, right? The same kind of prioritization that the exoteric term seems to enjoy. And when we do so, do we also observe that binary opposition breaking down, and we see the two terms of that opposition operating concurrently, right, at the same time? What we've been discussing so far is that radical novelty breeds Renaissance thinking in as much as it engenders or seems to catalyze a retrospective kind of appeal to antiquity. And that's
right,
that's the postmodern, that would be a postmodern read of where we are right now. And we could apply that to Agrippa, Plato, pre-Platonic, Parmenides, right? All the way back.
Uh-huh. I think I see what you're saying. And I think we've already kind of been doing that then, haven't we? Maybe not as purposefully as we could, but like Agrippa, I'm going to have to think about this a lot now. Thank you for putting all this stuff in my brain.
Sorry, mate.
Philosophers. all right. So then like we've been, this sort of does help kind of answer some of the questions that I was having earlier, or some of the confusion I was having earlier, looking at like the Protestant, you know, the early parts of Protestantism being both novel and appealing to tradition, where they were using an appeal to tradition to create a novel form of Christianity almost. Kind of in a way because their appeal to tradition was faulty. Like they didn't have a very complete knowledge of what early Christianity was.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, look, I think it was definitely something that happened, right? There were appeals to antiquity. Whether they were faulty or not, that's a different question. I tend to think that appeal to antiquity and appeal to tradition has a really valid place, actually, rather compared to novelty.
I think that's a tough one. I think that without an appeal to novelty, I mean, the thing is, like, we don't know if an appeal to novelty is good until we can have a retrospective on it, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Appeal to novelty is always a gamble. We're saying this is a new way of doing things. It's got to be better. And sure, we can produce a lot of evidence or arguments to support why we should do it, but you don't know if that was the right choice until later.
Yeah, that's true, but at the same time, look, appeal to novelty is really exciting, right? It's exciting because it offers something like the illusion of breaking out of the context in which the ideas form. And the reason why, for my money, like, I preference appeal to antiquity, although it's also a logical fallacy, like, let's not discount the fact that these are logical fallacies, right? But if you had to choose between fallacies, I would choose appeal to antiquity, because the reason for that, right, my reasoning for preferencing an appeal to antiquity is that what it implies is context, yeah? Uh-huh. Which is, I'm writing, let's just imagine we're Agrippa, right? And, you know, I'm writing this particular work, Three Books of Occult Philosophy, within the context of Aristotle said this, Plato said this. Here are all of my forebears and, you know, predecessors, and I'm adding to this kind of, you know, tradition by introducing X, Y, and Z interpretation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not he did that overtly or whether he simply made all of his points by appeal to antiquity, that's kind of beside the point, because that was sort of the modus operandi for a lot of writers, right? A lot of philosophers. Mm-hmm. It's Three Books of Occult Philosophy, let's not forget. The appeal to novelty has a really, you know, obviously quite sort of novel appeal, you know, like, and it's a stupid...
That was, what do you call that? A tautology? Was that a tautology?
Tautology, yeah. It's a tautology.
Oh, man, I think the PhD police are going to be after you for that one.
Oh, look, I mean, it's not going to rap sheet a mile long with those guys. You know, the appeal to novelty has the appeal of the fallacy of stepping outside of context, and it's understandable that people would get excited by something that's never happened before, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I think that the way that reality functions, and even talking about that now just seems beside the point, but if there was such a thing as reality, I think that it functions by a series of sedimentary or nested contexts in which we operate, and that you can't you just can't do an appeal to novelty without invoking an equal and opposite appeal to antiquity, because there's just the way that the human mind comprehends things is by breaking things down into binaries, the way that deconstruction works, right? And the way that we've been doing this postmodern reading, which I would mm-hmm. argue we can't help but do because this is postmodernity and what it looks like, is that we look at these two binaries and go, they're happening concurrently, right? The same thing is operating mm-hmm. At the same point, and it's just because of our need to conceptualize what's happening in Agrippa or what's happening in, you know, insert subject X here, that we have to think about it in terms of binary opposition. But the reality is that it's actually both things at once. The thing that we don't lose in a postmodern reading is context. We never lose context. And the thing about Derrida is there is no, his famous quote is, there is no outside text, right? You can't think outside of context. And so antiquity is there. And if we convince ourselves, and this was the point that I made right, you know, in the last episode, right, on my podcast, if we convince ourselves that we're not guilty of the same thing that we observe in Agrippa, where we're making appeals to antiquity but thinking that we're not, I think that's not aligned with how reality works. If I was in a different time, I would say that is not true, sir. I refute you thus. But mm-hmm. yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think that that's, I think that that's kind of one of the things that I would like, that I try to be careful of, and that I also really want to get across to people who are reading Agrippa now. Sometimes it's really easy. Like, you can read, you know, book one, The Natural World, and read a lot of the stuff that, like, Agrippa's pulling out of Pliny the Elder. And it's very, very simple to be like, this is bullshit. Like, I don't care if it's old, it's totally bullshit. But it also makes it really simple to miss over or to skip over the gems. You know, the things that maybe deal with an inner world or an inner perception or a more magical world or even like a Platonic worldview that aren't really like clashing with, you know, science, for instance, or that aren't really clashing with other things that in the modern world that we can, like, you know, prove through, you know, empiricism or whatever the hell we want to use. It's tricky, though. I mean, I'm sure you run into this with astrology all the time. Like, you know, that sort of question of, like, why the hell does this work? Or, you know, the question of, what is the mechanism for it? And does it matter that we can't figure that out?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. So I guess, you know, speaking about my own context, right? Like I was classically trained as a philosopher. I did the whole Aristotelian, let no one ignorant of geometry enter. You know, I did the logical thing, right? And so I had a very ensconced early 2000s atheistic materialist model of academic analysis of ideas. Prior to that, I was just a little psychic Wiccan in the 90s. But coming out of that into occult praxis full-time, which is what happened after the academic stuff, I was confronted with multiple instances that I observed that contradicted everything that I was, you know, that I was kind of convinced was the case beforehand. Astrology is just the lightest example of that because I'm also a magician. I practice magic.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jesus Christ, you want to talk about quasi-causation or spooky action at a distance or whatever you turn, you want to pop in there.
The weirdness of coincidences that defy statistical analysis.
Exactly. You know,
synchronicity.
Yes. If you want to engrave an image of a woman on a crab, there it is again. You know, and make that a lunar talisman and then get all of these effects that correspond exactly with what's described in the Agrippa. Go for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just there to be observed. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the thing that I find most important in my observations of how occult thought works these days, at least from my limited experience in the occultosphere. It's down to worldview, yeah? So our, you know, Italian king that went to bed dreaming of bulls woke up with horns. I especially on reflection, like your example of witches who control your mind by shooting blood out of their eyes and all of the other fun times that can be had with Pliny the Elder, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to poo-poo this, yeah? Okay, so like we look at it now and we're like, oh no, poo-poo, this is horrible. What are you talking about? It's bullshit. And yet there are gems there that are comprehensible to us because they go through the filter of our I think fundamentally atheistic materialist worldview that we struggle as occultists to get out of, right? It is a constant struggle to maintain a stance that is as distant from the influence of atheistic materialism as you possibly can, right? It's a struggle to do so. And because we're doing that, we find only a few gems in Agrippa. And not only does this, you know, imply that it pays to read and read and read three books of occult philosophy again, it also implies that, you know, we can't assume that we are outside the text. We are outside the context in general, yeah? And this is the great... Yeah. Sin of the appeal to novelty is to imagine that, no, we've got the truth and this is the new truth and this is the best truth and everything else before it can go to hell. It's not the case. You know, we're just going to be again confronted with the fact that we operate in a worldview that we need to. Otherwise, if we didn't have a worldview, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, for instance, and it's just part of the landscape.
Yeah, it's interesting. Speaking of having no outside text, you know, three books of occult philosophy ended up being so widely published and consumed and republished and plagiarized and redistributed under different names. Like, we live in a world that in which it is kind of part of the fabric of our society. In a more subtle way than other works, but it's been around for so long and it's been so influential in so many different parts. Like, there's no way for us to be outside of the text. Like, the three books of occult philosophy have just been messing with stuff for too long.
Exactly. And it's just because we're tuning into the frequency that is, you know, three books of occult philosophy that we're able to see.
Oh, see, now you're starting to sound like a 20th century occultist tuning into frequencies and stuff.
Well, that's good, right? So if we direct our organ towards three books of occult philosophy, if we sit inside our pyramids,
now hold on,
folks.
This is not that kind of podcast.
Okay, so look, if just because we happen to be thinking about three books of occult philosophy, we can see its broad-based distribution everywhere. And I mean, you know, as a side point, I think that's kind of the point, which is to meditate on one particular work, you know, until you can see it everywhere. But at the same time, not necessarily focus entirely on the fact that that work is gospel truth. You could focus on anything and see its distribution everywhere because it's all part of context. In as much as we can't help but assume the, you know, the ubiquity of three books of occult philosophy, we can also, by extension, and it's not, again, not a very long bow to draw, we can assume by extension that we have to accept the ubiquity of Aristotle, and we have to accept the ubiquity of Plato, and even
absolutely, yeah.
Even old Pliny, blood spurty out eyes, the elder himself would have that place everywhere. It's just part of the fine fabric of what makes up our particular worldview.
Did I tell you I did come across a folk magic, folk medicine thing in Pliny that is still used today?
No way. What is it?
Pliny has a thing where he talks about using cherries to treat gout.
Okay.
And I've got a friend who has gout, and he's like, oh, yeah. Because I was just sort of reading like a random sampling of stuff, and he's like, oh, yeah, that's still a thing. You know, doctors will tell you to drink cherry juice and eat a lot of cherries to help with gout. And I'm like, wow. Okay, well, I guess we're inside Pliny as well. There is no external Pliny text.
Exactly. There's no outside of Pliny. That's
crap,
hilarious.
We are screwed.
No, I wonder what underpins Pliny's reasoning that the cherries cure gout. I can't imagine that it was
due to a deep knowledge
of the vascular system or anything like that.
Oh, he didn't. He wouldn't have had that. You know, I mean, he died in 70 AD when Vesuvius exploded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was killed by the volcano.
Was he the one that was crossing a river on a boat and copped
it? He went back, it was noble. He went back to try to save people in and the pyroclastic cloud got him.
Shit. Oh well.
Happens, you know, I mean, it didn't happen to Pierce Brosnan in that movie.
Oh, that's great. That's great, Pierce Brosnan. Oh wow.
He's the newest avatar of Pliny the Elder for sure.
Oh, definitely. It's the mustache that gets me.
For sure.
But look, I mean, Pliny would have had a different way, probably some sort of correspondence, right? Like some sort of correspondence-based medical model that he was.
He might have. I have not spent enough time with his book. It's huge, and it's just difficult to deal with. So I honestly don't know. That's a really, really good question. That's something that, like, a historian of medicine would probably know more about than I would.
Well, look, I'm a big believer in there are no coincidences, right? So you brought up this example of Pliny. The folk cure for gout is cherries in Pliny, as it is in the modern day American medical system, right? Assuming your friend's in America. The worldview that justifies cherries as a cure for gout now is totally different, we can assume, to the worldview that justified cherries as a cure for gout back in the day.
Oh, right? I'm sure. Yeah.
And yet the same truth inheres in both, right? And the pathway, the methodology by which to observe that truth would probably remain unchanged, I would imagine, yeah? Or at the very least, it's something that's amenable to, we can do this now, we can do this right now. Right, we can have some way in which we arrive at the same conclusions as people in the past, and we assume that's coincidental. I don't believe that that's coincidental, right?
It's almost like it's almost the sort of thing where if modern science can prove that it works using their own methods, even though somebody already knew that it worked 2,000 years ago, then it's okay now.
Yeah, I'm going to
otherwise.
I'm going to get all Deepak Chopra on you right now and draw an appeal to quantum physics, my friend.
Like, you cannot appeal. I want you to know that I studied physics in college.
Oh, good.
So you could start to appeal to quantum physics, but I'll probably just shake my head.
No, please. I really want you to correct me. Because I fucking say this all the time, and I want a physicist to correct me on it just so that I'm not speaking out my ass, right? So we've got this thing called the decoherence of the wave function. Is that a thing? Is that a thing?
Yeah, I mean, you mean like the collapse of the wave function?
Yeah, the collapse of the wave function.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and I'm going to do a real sort of ham-fisted interpretation of this, which is kind of the basis of why I invoke it often. You have waves until you have an observer, and then you have particles, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
It depends on what you're observing and how the observation happens. If you try to measure the wave as a wave, it will be a wave. If you try to measure it as a particle, it'll be a particle.
Okay, but you try in both instances, you're trying to measure it, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's the observation of it. Yeah, but it basically does what you expect it to.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, I mean, you know, Agrippa's kind of doing what we expect him to do because we're observing him using. It's just the instrumentation that changes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Good. Well, I mean, I'm assuming that's not inconsistent or controversial or anything like that. But.
I mean, Agrippa's not a particle. You're making a metaphor. It's an analogy that, I mean, I guess we can use, but yeah.
All right. Okay. So my appeal, the same model is kind of doing what Agrippa's sort of saying that we were doing back in the day. You know, I can't think of any examples, but it just seems to have this sort of vibration of truth, you know, to kind of to get even more new age. Look, I mean, our worldview is going to make things, make waves, you know, behave the way we want them to because of the means by which we measure them and our expected results, right? So if we expect.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Holy shit.
Yeah.
All right, I see the analogy now. Like, that analogy has to do with the cherries.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And doing what they're doing, regardless of the way we measure them. Like, we can either, you know, I mean, maybe who knows what Pliny the Elder thought. Maybe he thought that cherries were, you know, the testicles of Apollo and
exactly.
Cure your gout. And because of his way of observing that and proving that they were the testicles of Apollo or whatever, the cherries were a valid solution or a valid cure or a valid treatment. And then now, once more, we instead have a scientist being like, oh no, it's got benzohydro blobbity blobbidium in it, and it, you know, dissolves uric acid crystals, and so that's why it works.
Exactly. Yeah. So, right. I mean, what that's pointing.
But to us, we can't tell either way. I have no way of testing that.
Oh no, but we can, because we're occultists, we're esotericists, we're privy to the hidden truth of the universe.
So we're more able to test the Apollo's Nards theory.
Yeah, it's all cojones, right? We're back at cojones.
Right.
Here. It's just cojones all the way down.
It's cojones all the way down.
Oh dear, we're going to get in a lot of trouble for that. But look, I think what we've got is we've got an instance where we can kind of see that there's something that operates outside of our worldview, but we have no choice but mm-hmm. to measure it. We can't help but measure the world. We can't help but observe the world that we're in, and we can't help but make that world decohere into something. Or collapse into something that we expect. Mm-hmm. And a great example of this, even just briefly through the history of philosophy and esotericism, is Plato. The Plato that I learned about in university is not the Plato that I'm familiar with today by a fucking long shot.
God, I know that one.
You know, and even back then, I was reading French authors like Luce Irigaray, who drew an example from the Symposium where Socrates talks about learning philosophy from a priestess who showed him mm-hmm. that it was an esoteric praxis, right? Where you sort of ascend the ladder of truth, and then you end up, you know, with this kind of knowledge of the form of the good. And that was not, you know, that didn't jive very well with the strict rationalist materialist that I was being told was Plato, the founder of Western philosophy, because that was just that how is... people expected it to decay. Sorry.
No, I'm just, it's disgusting to me that anybody ever tried to teach that Plato was like that. I just, it makes me sad. Ooh. I mean, Plato's got so much amazing, beautiful, weird shit going on.
Totally, and... totally. Yeah, an absolute trickster of a figure for sure. Mm-hmm. But look, I think with three books of occult philosophy, right? What we have to mm-hmm. be careful of is, you know, the calling out the appeal to antiquity as something that we're not guilty of, and the reason mm-hmm. why, right? And you know, this is kind of the point, right? The reason why we should be careful of that is because we're not really operating in, to my thesis is, we're not operating in a different way to the way that Agrippa was operating.
I kind of look at it as there is, hold on, let me see if I can put this into smart sounding words. I kind of look at it as a exploration of Agrippa is sort of like diving in, finding ideas, and then testing them to see if they are worth exploring or worth trying to apply in a modern world. You know, I mean, I think that we can look, you know, the one place where you and I have a really big overlap is that we both do astrological magic. And it feels to me a lot like astrological magic, the community of astrological magicians sort of went a little ways in kind of adopting the, you know, the methods and the philosophy behind it or the occult philosophy behind it, and then sort of stopped. You know, they sort of got to, like, you know, Al-Kindi's rays or whatever, and they're like, good enough for me. But through that, they ignored, I think, a lot of the thinking that was going on in astrological magic and in the imaginal or phantasmal worldview that existed for Renaissance magicians like Ficino and Agrippa and, you know, Giordano Bruno and all those sorts of like amazing visionaries who were doing this work because they believed in a world of forms or world of images that was more real than the physical world. You know, and I think that that gets lost a lot when in the discourse on astrological magic. So that's definitely one of the things that I am curious about exploring more in some of those older texts. So, you know, I dive in, I see if I can find the philosophy behind it, and then I'm like, how does this hold up? And does it hold up? And can we use this? That's sort of how I am doing it. And I don't know if that makes it an appeal to antiquity or an attempt to find ideas that got discarded and might need to be reevaluated. I'm not sure.
Well, I think the important thing is you're doing the work, right? No, I'm serious. And yeah. I guess the philosophical thing, right? Because my big thing is, yeah, I've got training as a philosopher, but my work is practice-based now. So I see clients, mm-hmm. I do readings. I do real fast, quick-fire readings at markets with tarot. 15 minutes mm-hmm. in and out. I don't have time to get into, you know, the theory of the forms or the theory of the rays or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When I'm just talking to someone about their marriage. And, you know, I do astrological readings and I make talismans. I'm also like a jeweler and I taught myself jewelry making and I make these things.
Mm-hmm.
But the philosophy behind it can sometimes fall into that juxtaposition with, you know, the whole two camps of occult practitioners. There's armchair occultists that seem to be completely happy to just explore the ideas and to, you know, have the books and to have that knowledge and to explore it. And then there are the practitioners who, from experience, and it's limited experience, right? But from experience, tend not to want to engage with the philosophy. They just want the correspondences from Agrippa. So again, we're back mm-hmm. to three books of occult philosophy as ubiquitous because it divides, mm-hmm. it's polarizing in some sense. You know, on the one hand, you've got practitioners. On the one hand, you've got theoreticians. The fact that you and I are both simultaneously means that we get a purview into the deeper gnosis that you can achieve by engaging with a text like Three Books of Occult Philosophy consciously and with the intention of having that philosophical, whatever gold you're able to, you know, draw out of it through the means mm-hmm. of philosophy and reason, augmenting your practice, right? And not having logic and reason being antithetical to mystical gnosis and to spiritual awareness, which is sometimes the case, mm-hmm. and it's really just a trauma response to atheistic materialism.
Oh my God, we're writing that down.
We're all just a little bit post-traumatic from our Cartesian head wound, to quote Gordon White. But, you know, there's that sense of, you know, we're just a little bit kind of traumatized into thinking that reason and logic is antithetical to occult practice, and it's... I'm here to tell you folks, mm-hmm. it's not the fucking case, right? And trust me on this. You know, you can do the work and have a logical and reasonable understanding if you see logic and reason as a means to an end. Because even in the example that you just provided, Eric, you said, oh, look, it's worthwhile to engage with this to see which ideas need to be reevaluated, to inquire philosophically, mm-hmm. right? It's a means to an end. It's always there to kind of mm-hmm. push you forward to as a practical path to gnosis. And the reason why we tend to assume logic and reason are an end unto themselves is because science has fucking made it the case, right? Like it's atheistic materialism and, you know, it kind mm-hmm. of is my nemesis at the moment, that and capitalism, right? Atheistic materialism mm-hmm. pushes us into assuming that there's just an end called reason when it's just not the case. Like even Plato was saying, you use reason to observe or to divine the form of the good, to experience the form of the good. So there's that aspect of engaging with the text, right? And one should be cautious about assuming that, first of all, the appeal to tradition is a mortal sin. I don't think that it is. It's bad, but you shouldn't really do it. You mm-hmm. should engage philosophically, and dare I say it, I'm going to say it scientifically, with the text, right?
right.
But it's a means to an end. The end is gnosis. We're in this game because we want to kind of have that knowledge of the Godhead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think that kind of drives all of us, the theurgic goal. I mean, at least it drives practitioners. I'm not sure about other people.
Yeah, and also it's nice to get rich and get laid, right? There's also that. So,
I mean, isn't that why we have musical instruments?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, look, I was a bit wary about getting the kalimba out, but I think our listeners uh-huh. can contain themselves.
I'm not going to publish your home address or anything like that, so don't worry.
Thank you.
You won't have your spouse won't have to be out there, fending off all of the amorous Australian listeners who are like, oh.
I don't use the term modern day Orpheus much, but I'm not going to start now, guys. Don't worry.
I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think, and I hope through those connection issues that we were having at the beginning, I think there's enough for a whole episode here.
Oh, thank God. it's been amazing, mate.
Why don't you tell the listeners where you can be found? I'm going to put some faith in the listeners. I'm going to say, listeners, thank you all for being really good listeners and for checking out my appearance on the Dragonstone Astrology podcast already, where you already heard all of the things about where Matt Dragonstone can be found on both the internet and in the world. So, but I will still let him tell you again, because I know that it is that repetition is important for learning. So, Dr. Matt, would you please tell the extremely well-behaved listeners?
You're very kind, my reverend friend. Guys, you can find me at dragonstoneastrology.com. That's really the place where you should go for all the stuff. You can book in for a reading. You can read about me. You can see the talismans. You can read a few of the articles that I've written. And if you're on the social media hellhole that is Facebook or Instagram, it's Dragonstone Astrology. And on Instagram for talismans, it's Dragonstone Materia. The podcast is out there too. So Spotify or website as well. Now, all your favorite podcast catchers will have the Dragonstone podcast. I'm not imaginative with my naming of things. It's just the Dragonstone whatever.
You only had to be imaginative once.
Yes, exactly. Even that was a co-creation. The surname is a co-creation with my partner. I can just dream it up.
It's a great name.
Thank you,
it's
mate.
A great name.
Cheers, mate.
Well, thank you so much. I think it's very possible that there's going to be a part three after I maybe read a Derrida book and we have to argue about this a little bit more. But for now, that's a show.
Thank you so much, my friend. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're a gentleman and a scholar.
This has been another episode of the Arnomancy Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I have been your host, Reverend Eric. You can find Arnomancy online at arnomancy.com, and you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere podcasts are found. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the Arnomancy Project for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/arnomancy.
Vanessa Urena, and I'm really excited to announce my new store, Sword and Scythe, where I'll be offering magical art, materia, and services beneath Mars and Saturn. You can visit the store at swordandscythe.com and be sure to sign up for the email list to receive early access to new releases.